This is Profiles in Risk. Hosted by Nick Lamparelli. Every week, we interview those who risk life, limb, fortunes, career, and reputation, and those who work behind the scenes who look to protect and enlighten us about risk. You can find the show notes and other insurance-related content at insnerds.com. That's insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Profiles in Risk. I am your host, Nick Lamparelli. Very pleased on a late Friday afternoon. What a way to end this week. I have Chris Jarvis with me. As you can see, Chris is a best-selling author. He's an insurance expert and an entrepreneurial strategist. He's also an applied mathematician, actuary, and an economist, or does economic strategy, and is highly focused on helping people find their path to their true potential, enjoy their lives, and succeed in serving others. Chris, happy Friday afternoon.
Thanks, Nick. Happy to be with you, and can't think of a better way to, it's a much better way to spend than studying for an actuarial exam, so I'm happy
absolutely,
to be here.
Absolutely. I'll have to send you a link to one of the interviews I did. It was with David Wright, who's an actuary, works for a reinsurance firm, and one of the things that struck me about my conversation with him, we brought it up a few times, I think he's getting tired of it, is him weeping after an exam. Like, it's just, when I think of David Wright, I think of weeping. I don't know why. So I know how hard that is. You have an incredibly broad skill set. How the heck have you been able to cram all that in?
Good question. So some of it I think is natural ability. Some things you catch on to pretty easily, and other things I would say are a little more adaptive. My severe ADD gives me something around a 30 to 45 second attention span. So real hard to stay with anything for 5 or 10 years. I'm an idea guy. I'm a futurist. I'm a strategist. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that just drive me. So when I'm watching TV, I'm usually watching a nature show, or I'm watching a history show, or I like the learning part, and I'm fascinated with new things. So some of this is, I wouldn't say a morbid curiosity, because it hasn't killed me yet, but I would say an extremely overactive curiosity to what else is out there. So as a result, I've seen a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I think we're simpatico that way, because in my free time, my wife, even last night, was like, you have the TV on YouTube and you're watching documentaries on World War II. It's like, yeah, it's like I'm learning something. Like, what else is there to watch? That's entertaining. So I love that. I really enjoyed your book, Six Secrets to Leveraging Success. I'm going to go into this quite a bit, because I learned a lot. And I especially like the different view from the top. Like, it's opaque. You actually have a term. I think everyone that's listening to this probably has heard the term glass ceiling, which you describe as you can see where you want to go, but there's something impeding you from getting there. You bring up the concept of the crystal ceiling. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So you mentioned the glass ceiling, so I won't be redundant, but I'll point out that the glass ceiling of not getting where you can see and where you want to go is because of your race, your religion, the color of your skin, your gender, your sexual orientation. It's something that, you know, is holding you back. The crystal ceiling is the exact opposite. So I guess it's not the best metaphor to go from glass to crystal, but the important part of the crystal ceiling is you have a vague idea of what life looks like on the other side. You've been successful. You make $200,000-$400,000 a year, $500,000 a year. You're working your ass off, and you've accomplished it. You've done more than your parents and more than a lot of your friends. And it seems like it's not enough. And you're ashamed or guilty saying that to other people, because they're thinking, well, you should be really happy. Look how much money you make, and you're so successful. But then you realize you don't have a private jet. You don't have floor seats for the, you know, for the basketball team. You don't drive the super luxury vehicle. You don't vacation around the world. You don't do a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. And there is no path to going from making $400,000 to making $4 million. There is no clear thing for you to do. Anybody on the call could probably think of 50 ways to make $300,000 a year. You could go to law school. You could go to med school and become any one of 40 subspecialists. You could own 3 McDonald's. You could become a partner in an accounting firm. And there's a lot of things you could do to make $300,000. But what do you do to make $3 million or $4 million? And there is no job that you can just show up to, be a good citizen, bust your ass,
yep,
put in the time, put in some overtime, work some Saturdays and occasional Sunday, and you'll wake up making $3 million in 30 years. It just doesn't exist. And so this crystal ceiling is, What is life like on the other side? What is it like for the 1% of the 1%? And what are they doing? How did they get there? How can I get there? And, you know, to kind of double down on the crystal part of it, this isn't you can't get there because you're black, because you're a woman, because you're Jewish, because you're gay, because you're, you know, something. This is you can't get there because of you. And your success is actually the thing that's killing you and keeping you from getting to the next level, because there is no way to get to that super successful level of making millions of dollars a year by actually working. So the more successful you are, you know, the less likely you are to get there.
And what else I took from the crystal analogy or metaphor is that because a crystal's prism-like, the view on the other side is distorted. So probably what you think they're doing or their habits or whatever successful traits that they have is a distortion to you. So mimicking that specifically also may not help you as well.
Without a doubt. I like that a lot. And that's, that is true. And it is without a doubt, it's distorted. People think that they're doing something that they're not. And it's, what didn't show up in my bio is that I spent a lot of time in financial services. When I left the PNC actuarial side, I had set up captives and run captives for hundreds of companies. I sold that company. I've written 15 books. I've done a lot of financial planning and spoken at hundreds of conferences mm-hmm. around the world. And generally when you're helping people with taxes and their money, the folks who have the most complicated problems make the most money. So I had a chance to work with billionaires and 100 millionaires and people with a lot of wealth. And you just saw what they did, and it was really different. I mean, the things that they did were the way they looked at things, and the things that they spent time on were very different from the doctor or the attorney or the, you know, the hardworking executive yeah. who shows up to work. They just looked at things very, very differently. And every single one of them was, every one of them that I've talked to, and there have been dozens, if not 100, have told me that their ideas were not particularly well received early on.
Yeah.
In
your, I will link to this in your podcast that you did with Michael Janz. You talked about time, and that becomes a critical element because everyone has the same amount of currency in regards to time. We all have 24 hours, and mm-hmm. so what struck me from your book and from the conversation, which I knew, you know, I think it, people inherently know, is that you can only work so many hours, and so. And I like the way you connected how, like, you know, if you're going to go to school and you're going to get an education and you're going to get a job, you still have only so many hours. So the idea is to get the job that's going to pay you the most for the amount of hours that you're going to work. But then that's it. Like, you hit that ceiling, and to get to the other side, it's not a question. I mean, it could be a question of skills or other things, but it's really a time optimization problem. And I remember having a conversation with someone who said the only way rich people can get rich is they have to make money while they're sleeping. Like, they have to have systems or processes in place where transactions are occurring, their wealth is increasing while they're sleeping. And then I heard your time, your time concept, and I said, yeah, it's the same thing. Like, you somehow have to just boot your business to some other level where it's not you that's working. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. The phrase that I use to oversimplify it is you will not become super successful. And by super successful, I mean you get past the 1%, you're making hundreds of thousands of dollars, to get to the 0.1 or 0.01% mm-hmm. where you're making millions of dollars. You will not get there until you realize that your time is worth more than money. So when you truly realize time is worth more than money, you have a shot at really becoming successful. So when you start valuing time more, then you think of things differently. You know, for example, if I said, what fun thing are you going to do this weekend? You might say you're going to watch some basketball. You might say you're going to go for a walk on the beach. You might say you're going to some restaurant. And, you know, I don't know what you're going to say. If I told you you were going to die on Monday morning and asked you what you're going to do for fun this weekend, you might do something very different.
Yeah.
In the just realizing I have very little time, therefore I have to be particularly determined and, you know, really go for something big because I only have so much time. So think of Steve Jobs, who, you know, died with a lot of money and he has no time left. So, you know, there's not to be that morbid. I guess I was going to have to work morbid back into the conversation at some point correctly. You know, when you realize that time is the greatest asset and the most valuable increment or resource you have, it will change how you feel about and how you act. Because otherwise, when I used to work with doctors, and I've worked with thousands of them, I would tell them that they basically cut lawns for a living. And, you know, some would laugh and some would not get it and some would take issue with it. And I said, whether you're doing brain surgery or cutting a lawn, at the end of the day, you're getting paid a certain amount of money to do a task. And it might be a big number, but it's you're still limited by the amount of brain surgeries you can do. And it's not even your time. You also have to have the hospital and the surgery center. And are you going to find teams? And do you have the beds? And there's just all these limiting things that you have to get past that. And it's the same reason why any CEO who's sitting on the phone, if it's a CEO of a, you know, a CEO of a mutual company is making a lot less money than a CEO of a public company potentially, because the public company CEO is taking stock and equity and, you know, has a chance to get some upside and different aggravation risk reward conversation on the blanks. Yeah. But who's making money? The salespeople make more money than the internal staff, or they can make more money. Right. So you really have to think about that time thing of where is your time. And I find that most people who are in a sales capacity, they always look at the top line. And I tried it when I'm teaching my giraffe selling courses and I do boot camps and all kinds of things for insurance companies and people all over the world. The concept of minimizing your time. So efficiency, which you brought up, is how much you make is in the numerator and how much you spend is in the denominator. So the mathematician in the room has to go back to fractions and, you know, piss off a lot of people on the call. But when the denominator gets closer and closer to zero, the value of the fraction goes to infinity. So if you can find things that are very little work for you that make you money, you should do a lot of those things. And that's, you know, that's a big part of what I see wealthy people doing is figuring out how can I get the best bang for the buck, to oversimplify.
And in order to sort of train your brain to think that way, in your book, in your Six Secrets to Leverage Success, you say successful people are psychotic. And, you know,
you must be psychotic to become successful, I think is the title of the chapter. Yeah.
So, you know, it's something that's dawned on me that I realize, you know, there is a difference between people that are super successful and people who are willing to work, start out working 80 hours a week and just have that psychotic element to their personality where they're just they're ravenous about getting the business to a particular point or whatever, something that I don't know if I have. Can you talk about successful people in the psychotic statement? It's not psychotic like crazy psychotic, it's psychotic in what way?
No, it very well may be psychotic in the crazy way. So okay. So let's think back to psychology class and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. The first thing you need is you need air and you need water and you need food.
Yeah.
The second thing that everybody craves is security, safety. You need to know that you're not going to walk outside your house and a saber-toothed tiger is going to bite your head off. Like, you'd like to not have that level of anxiety, right? That you're just going to die immediately because you're, you know, living in a, you know, war zone or some type of really difficult place. Well, the third level in Maslow's hierarchy is you need love and belonging and you need to fit in. And what we find is that people who are super successful do not have the need for love and belonging. Doesn't mean that they don't love people and that they're you know, serial killers or anything else. But what I found from all my clients and friends and even, I guess, myself to some extent, to be very successful, you have to do something different. So my tagline is see differently, business differently. And I try to train companies and people all the time to think differently, do something differently, go way out on a limb, because doing things like everybody else is only going to get you to be just like everybody else. And if you're going to do things the same way as everybody else in your training class or every company in your industry or every agency that works with your company, then success is going to be determined by luck. If you all do things the same way, if you all use the same systems, if you all use the same trainers, if you all use the same marketing company, advertising company, then it's all going to be luck driven if you use the same stuff. But if you want to be an outlier, this is the big point. If you want to be an outlier financially, you can't be in the middle of the pack on everything else. You can't be the normal guy, just like everybody else, who just happens to have 10 times as much money. Like, you have to be an outlier. I mean, if you're going to be an outlier, you're going to be an outlier. There is no, there's no way to be socially like everybody else, but financially be better. I mean, there is something to truly embracing the fact that all my wealthiest clients all would tell me that when they had their big idea, the one that put them over the top, many of them had numerous successes, but they all had the one, right? The one thing that they would say was their big foray into wealth and success. When I asked them, what can you tell me about that idea? And when you first had it, they remember where they had it. They remember a lot of stuff and get this big smile on their face. And then I asked, what did everybody say when you told them about it? And they said, they told me I was effing nuts. Like, you're crazy. That's a terrible idea. It will never work. You can't do that. And everybody goes into the, I just want to protect you. I'm your friend. Why would you leave that job where you're making all this money to go set up this other company? It's a stupid idea. Are you really sure you want to do that? And they all said, yep, you're right. And they went and did it anyway. And so the idea that you have to truly believe in your idea and not care at all what anybody else says. And one of the analogies that I came up with, another metaphor, I guess, is innovation is done on a unicycle. You know, it's not done in a team event. I mean, it's a one-man show and one-woman show. Your innovation is your idea and nobody else is part of it. Don't look for a team for innovation. You're just not going to get it. You've got to go out on your own, and that's how you're going to innovate, is by being lonely and not wanting everybody to agree with you. And if you have a great idea, go with it and assume the more people hate your idea, probably the more innovative it is. If everybody likes your idea, it's not that good of an idea.
This really hits home. You know, if you listen, there's that podcast, How I Built This by Guy Raz. And if you listen to those stories, story after story after story, I would say almost all of them, it's either a ridiculous idea, like I'm going to rent my spare bedroom to strangers, right? Just ridiculous. Yeah. And everyone said it was ridiculous. And somehow that's like $100 billion business now. Mm-hmm. Or it was, you know, I always, to me, like Southwest Airlines is always like the model company. They did things that anyone else could have done decade after decade after decade. And the airline still didn't copy it. And they were the only ones that made money. And, you know, they would have been told by business professionals, you know, consultants or whatever, you can't do that. You know, that's ridiculous. That's not good business practice. And what hits home is the word beige. It's in your book. I think it's chapter one. And it's you can't be beige if you want to be successful. You have to, be the person with the purple hair or stick. Like it's somehow, some way, not only does your business idea have to stick out, I think you have to stick out somehow to get people's attention or anything like that. I just can't understate that enough, because it what you're saying really fits with the way that I have seen things over the past 20 years in my business career, is that there of course there's going to be a lot of luck, but it's the things that stick out. You want to be the needle in the haystack, not the haystack.
Right. And Nick, for the people who are listening who haven't had the opportunity to read the book yet, you talked about the chapter Stop Being Beige. So there's a couple friends of mine, a company that I've invested in, and called Roger and Chris. So rogerandchris.com. And they're designers who design furniture. And their whole thing is, let's do really cool American-made high-quality furniture for less than the cost of going to Pottery Barn or any of these big, places that have to source all their stuff in China, and then there's formaldehyde in the wood, and it's all kinds of chemicals and things that are irritating people, and they do it cheaper. But their big thing, if you go to rogerandchris.com, is their big thing is color. You want a pink couch? I'll give you a pink couch. You want orange? We'll give you orange. You want your school colors? Like, design should be full of color, not. And Roger had a long career on TV and some of those, you know, Flip That House and other programs. So he's a celebrity decorator, and Chris is truly gifted too. But so their whole thing was, when I was talking to Chris and interviewing him about some innovation stuff, his comment was, he was actually helping me build and decorate my house that I just moved into. But he said, if you ask a group of people for a color, the group will always give you beige. And the point is, beige is not, it's not exciting, but it's not going to turn anybody off. It's boring. It's simple. It sucks. Mm-hmm. That's his quote. And so whenever you ask a lot of people, you'll always end up with beige. You'll never get a committee of 9 people to say, let's go with purple, or let's go with bright green, or let's go with crimson, or let's go. They just won't, because groups will tend to move toward, you know, some of the groups want something really cool and some want something really hot. And so as a result, you end up with beige. So to that point about a committee, is you won't do anything really exciting if you ask a group to get you there. So, you know, I really do think innovation, you can ask people for ideas, but at the end, one person has to go with it. And the more people who are involved in that process, the less interesting the idea is going to be. And I sit on a lot of boards, and it's amazing when you get in the room what people want to do. And inevitably, I'm the guy who's, you know, got to stand up and say, I don't care which crazy idea you want in the room, mine or somebody else's, but good God, please pick one that nobody else would ever do. You're not going to become successful by being incrementally more efficient or a little more something. And most people really struggle with that.
Yeah, the whole risk aversion. And we see that in insurance, massively.
It's in the definition.
I'm starting to hear stories of capacity being pulled out of California because of the wildfires. And, you know, I get it. You know, when you take it on the chin, it hurts. And sometimes you want to pick up your chips. But, you know, Warren Buffett made all of his money by buying low and selling high. And
not the other way around.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. So there are going to be people listening to this that are just uncomfortable. You know, they may not even want to be like the super successful, but they do want to be successful, but don't want to stand out. They don't want to be an outlier in one way or another. But one way that I think I have seen people have stand out without having purple hair or having crazy personalities is their ability to ask questions, to kind of tease out insights. And you wrote 2 books on questions, which I will add to the show notes. Why are questions and why is the questioning skill set so valuable in business or innovation? I just think it's valuable almost everywhere. Why is it so valuable? Why did you write 2 books on it? It must have been pretty valuable for you to write 2 books on it.
I hope so. I wrote them. I didn't buy them, so I don't know how valuable it is. I guess I spent a lot of time. So it's, questions are really important. My dad was a salesperson for a long time, very successful, and he gave me the advice I'm sure a lot of people's parents gave them, which was, you have 2 ears and 1 mouth. You should be listening twice as much as you talk. And that's important. And I mentioned your first question was where I developed the skill set, and it came from this curiosity of how things fit. And my parents would say as a kid that I would be more interested in how did the amusement park rides work than actually riding them was not interesting at all. So I was much more interested in how things work than I always have been. But the questions are, some of my biggest cases and biggest successes and opportunities came from asking questions, and they came from legitimate and honest interest in what people were doing and what are they running into and what problems are they facing. And you know, I think that's really important for anybody who's in a client-facing job, is to ask a lot of questions. Maybe what we'll do is make one of the books of questions available for free to anybody in your group who wants to go to my website. I'll get a code for you, like RISC or something, and they can download one of the question books for free, if that would be helpful. And these are good questions for client-facing salespeople, and they're not particularly questions. I mean, they were written for people in the financial services world, so they're skewed toward that. But the questions aren't. They're not product-driven questions. They're questions about people and things that are important to them. And ultimately, the connection is more important than the product. But the other thing about questions that's really important is when I had a mentor when I was at business school. I did my MBA at UCLA, and I had won a fellowship or scholarship from Young Presidents Organization, YPO, and a guy named Hunt Ramsbottom, who happened to be from Rhode Island, and I was from Rhode Island. We were out in California, kind of took me under his wing and was teaching me about a lot of things. And he had had a couple of successful roll-ups and was working on his third one. And long story short, what he told me one of his most valuable business practices was that when he started doing a roll-up, he fired all the senior management that had spent their career in the industry that that he was in. So if it was a company that was in automotive, he'd fire all the automotive executives at the senior level, and he'd bring in people from other industries. And I said, well, why do you do that? He said, well, I'm not going to get any innovative ideas if I just have a bunch of people who are going to tell me, this is how we've done it. This is how we've always done it. This is the way it goes. And I said, yeah, but who's going to run the company? He said, well, I have 800 employees who come to work every day and don't have to ask their boss, you know, where the file is, where the thing is. I'll just ask anybody, how do you do it? They've been doing the work. So the senior management team isn't supposed to be micromanaging operations. They're supposed to be setting strategic vision and helping us make really big decisions. So I don't want anybody on my strategic team who's in my industry. I want people who are from other industries. And I said, okay, like, I said, well, I've got a guy who's in dairy farming, who's on my automotive board. I've got a guy from import export. I've got somebody from oil and gas. I've got somebody from personal service. I've got somebody from healthcare, because I want people to ask the most important question, which is why not, or why can't we, or couldn't we? I mean, those are really valuable questions. So for any executive who's on the board here, if you don't have a board full of disruptive people, there's only one of two reasons. One, you didn't know better and you just, you know, had everything else, or you're an egomaniac and you just want a bunch of people you can control to do what you want them to do. You know, I mean, it's one or the other, because you should have people asking questions. And that's not meant to sound super egomaniacal on my own side, but I love Abraham Lincoln with his, you know, his cabinet was full of his harshest critics, and his position was, I want as close to me as possible the people with the most, the strongest dissenting opinions, so we can talk about it and figure out what's there. Because if you really think it should be red and I think it should be green, we need to think about this and, you know, figure out which one is the right answer, because it's not to blend them and create beige.
Yeah. So my background's in science. This brings up like a really, really good, I think, connection point to sort of explain like how this can expand to anything. Why questioning is just so important. You know, I'm trained as a biologist. Of course, I believe in evolution. So when the first scientists started coming out with intellectual, you know, intelligent design, that evolution is too highly improbable, there had to be a guiding hand helping that, you know, there was, in the scientific world, there was, you know, a lot of commotion about that, a lot of anger. And I happened to read one of those books by one of those scientists, and I didn't agree with everything he said, but he completely brought up questions that I didn't think had solid answers. And I viewed it as, well, this is an opportunity for you to fine-tune your theory. Don't look at it as someone that's challenging you. Look at it as an opportunity. These are questions that can improve what you do or what this is, and make it even stronger. You can, to use a Taleb thing, you make it anti-fragile. Just get stronger with the more stress that you put on it. If you can knock down those objections, your presentation is even stronger, because right, you can knock down all of the objections.
I agree. I think that's part of the curiosity of why not. So yeah. I would say asking those questions and bringing really, and if you're not a CEO of a company that has a formal board, you can have a small company or agency with an advisory board. If you're, I've got some mentors who are pretty powerful to me, and they ask me very interesting questions and give me substantial challenges to keep me on my toes. And so even if that's the case, having an advice, whether you join a Vistage or a YPO or a YEO or some company, or you just hire some people and say, I'd love to get your advice, and offer to pay them for their time, even if it's something less than what it is, just say, hey, I'd love to pay you $200-$500 bucks a month, something, and I'd love to run some ideas by you and just, you know, get your input. Most people will be flattered by that and say, yeah, I'm happy to meet you for coffee once a month or talk on the phone just to give you some you know, some guidance. There's to think you know everything. That's, you know, that's the wise man knows himself a fool. So
yeah.
I would think it makes a lot of sense to have somebody just question your stuff. And to that, you know, to that point, if you believe in, if you're pro-choice and someone's pro-life and asks you a question or vice versa, if they can ask you a question that makes you completely shake how you believe in something, then that's pretty powerful.
I mean, yep.
It's a gift, because ultimately you want to have the fine tuning and feel comfortable with your position. So I think it's, I mean, that just comes natural to me because I have the curiosity and I'm always willing to accept that I'm probably doing something pretty wrong.
I think having that mindset is being an outlier, because I just think, you know, I struggle with it. I would always like to get better at it, just like I would like to, you know, be better at exercise and stuff. It's just something I have to continuously work on. But the ones that have that skill set really do stand out. And I think they ultimately, though, I've seen situations where younger professionals, I could pinpoint that they had that skill set. And then sure enough, you see them 10 years later and they're, you know, they're leaders, they're executives, they're making a mark, they're doing things. And so for like people that are listening, even, you know, the 0.1%, that's a big hurdle to overcome. But even to be successful, it's still going to require a particular skill set, and you still sort of want to stand out. And speaking of standing out, you don't seem to particularly have a long neck, but you refer to yourself on your website as the giraffe CEO. So, before I go into insurance related questions and finish off the podcast, can you give us the background on a giraffe CEO?
Yeah. So earlier we talked about learning, and I mentioned the nature shows, and that was something that I shared with my father when I was a kid. I watched a lot of nature shows, and I share it with my kids. And if they come in the room, there's a damn good chance I'm watching something on BBC or on National Geographic or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always into animals, and I believe that animals give us a lot of insights into people, because we are just mammals. And one of the things that I've noticed in watching countless hours of animals and going on safari and doing all these wonderful things is that every prey animal has evolved to protect itself. They have poisonous skin on the back of a frog. There's a quill on the back of a porcupine. There's camouflage so you can't see the animal. There's a shell. There's something. Animals learn to burrow to go underground. There's all these interesting things that prey animals do. All of them except for the giraffe. So over time, the giraffe has actually taken its most vulnerable area, its neck, which incidentally has the same number of vertebrae as we do. We have 7, they have 7. And the Wow. giraffe has actually made its neck longer. So it has evolved to not only to not hide its most vulnerable area, but to actually expose it and advertise it. And so the giraffe, which is the only animal that has gone the other direction, which is I'm impossible not to see. I'm 19 feet tall. I've got a 7-foot neck. It's not hard to find me, but as a result of sticking my neck out, literally, figuratively, being vulnerable, I can reach things that no other grazing animal can, and I can see things that no other animal can. So for me, when I was kind of doing a little self-assessment years ago, when I was going through some coaching, what makes me different? Why am I successful? Why do billionaires and millionaires hire me to do stuff, when in the insurance world, I'm selling the same commodity products everybody else is selling? And I tried to figure out, am I just lucky? What is it? I would ask people if the meetings I had were helpful, and they would say yes. And I would not stop to pat myself on the back, but rather dig a little deeper and ask why. And what I found was that people said after meeting with me, they were thinking about things differently. They were seeing things differently. And so as I started thinking about, you know, what is it? I just happened to read some giraffe stuff and some of the totems and symbolism of the giraffe, and it all seemed to make sense. And mm-hmm. the idea of trying to build a tower, which is a group of giraffes, to all see things differently and help elevate other people's perspectives. That's my, you know, my go-to signature in one of my books, which might be elevate your perspective, see a better path, be the giraffe. You know, and that's where the giraffe comes from. So if someone asks me on a plane, what do you do? I say, I turn people and companies into giraffes. Like, what the hell do you mean? So, and then we can have an interesting conversation.
Yeah, of course.
How we do it. So it's a long answer. I apologize, but
no, I love that. I love
you
that.
Might, that's, you might notice that, the giraffe rug in the back and the purple giraffe print on the wall, and you know, it's
yes,
I have. Try to live it.
Your website has the 3 giraffe logo.
Mm-hmm.
So is that you and your kids?
It is not. That is that's the idea that what I'm trying to do when I'm consulting or coaching people is to just help them elevate their perspective too. So we're all going in different directions. So
nice.
That's yeah.
I like that. I like that a lot. It is an insurance related podcast, so let's ask a couple of insurance related questions. Very tumultuous time in insurance for both the distribution side and for the capacity side. Lots of things going on, lots of technology coming in, really disrupting things that are going on. Let's use the giraffe view. Let's peek out over some of the trees and the shrubbery and see if we can see a pathway. If you're advising insurance execs, mm-hmm. Regarding all of this commotion that's going on in the industry, and it could, I mean, you can do it from whatever side you want, distribution and or the capacity side. How would you advise them, in this tumultuous time to move to something where they can reduce the risk of, failure, but also find a pathway they can thrive?
So if you think about the bell curve of an organization, so a company that's in startup mode needs the entrepreneur and someone to spark their interest, right? And so the company gets off the ground and gets a little bit excited. And then when you start to get a bunch of adopters, now you need operations people because you got to put systems in place so that you can grow your systems and do things a little more interestingly. Most companies lose their entrepreneur when they're going through all that operational stuff because we don't have a lot of patience to stick around. Then what ends up happening is it goes from the entrepreneurial startup team driving the firm to the operations and management team driving the firm. When HR and legal are driving your decisions, you are an industry in decline. So when HR and legal are talking about, this is how we do things, this is our manual, no, we can't do that, be careful of the lawsuit. If you see that, then you're an industry in decline or you're a company in decline, one or the other. And for sure, that's what's been going on in insurance for a while. Mm-hmm. So people haven't been focusing on what are the needs of the clients, what are the needs of our customers, how do we give them what they want? People don't want to fill out paper. I can't believe applications are still paper in the insurance world. Why can't I do it on an app? Why do I have to see anybody? Why have to talk to anybody? The customer experience generally sucks. People don't like insurance. It's not a strong view of the industry at all. The insurance people would say, and I've been one for a long time, would say, yeah, but we have this reputation. We've helped a lot of people.
Sure.
There was an article recently about Facebook and Google, and I think it said Amazon and Google, and it basically said 20% of Americans who work with large, well-known companies would have no problem buying insurance from Google or Amazon. And Google and Amazon haven't paid any claims. So they don't have, so these companies will hide behind their 175 years of history paying claims, and at the end of the day, the consumers don't give a shit. I mean, it's not what they want. So they want the fact that they buy a product at 8:30 in the morning and it shows up at their house at 4 o'clock from Amazon and shipping is free. Like they consider that to be good customer service. So what I find most insurance companies and executives looking at is they're talking about, is it the new compliance regulation? What am I doing with reserving? What about risk-based capital? What about, how is solvency one or two affecting me with my international business? They're all looking at the regulatory stuff. And if you're just chasing the regulatory stuff, I think there's a sign that you're going in the wrong direction. Not that you can ignore it because you have to do it, but if you focused on getting the consumers on your side and building a set of community and trying to change the way people feel about what you do, I think that's a valuable lesson. And I spent some time in the auto industry because I had done some captives for Toyota and I was an auto insurance actuary before that. And the car buying experience is like that too, right? So for a lot of people, the car buying experience mm-hmm. sucks. Because you don't want to deal with the dealer and it's high pressure and most people just don't enjoy it. So a lot of companies have gone down the road of, they said, let's make the car buying experience not suck, which is the best way I can describe it. So you have Carvana and you had CarMax and you had Saturn. And I just bought a Tesla and I went into the shop and said, can I buy it? They said, yeah, go online and buy it. We can't, there's one price. It's all there. Do what you want and come back if you want to talk about the options. But no, we don't get a commission and just, mm-hmm. go buy your car and they'll tell you when to pick it up. Saab's out of business. Volvo just did something. So my wife was super excited to see that Volvo has their overseas delivery. And this actually makes a lot of sense for insurance people, not whether you do car insurance, auto insurance or not. What Saab did was they didn't say, let's make a bad experience a decent experience. They said, let's make a bad experience a fantastic experience. And I think of that as a very giraffe-like view of the world. What they do in their overseas delivery program is if you buy a Volvo, they will pay for you and a guest to fly over to Sweden, put you up in a 4-star hotel and let you take the, you know, take the car off the assembly line or whatever, you know, whatever it is, showroom, drive it around their test track, and then they'll ship it home to you. And so they just gave you an experience. So rather than going down and talking to the guy with the pinky ring and the, you know, and the gold chain trying to sell you a vehicle, your buying experience now became, I went to Sweden. And so whether that works or not, if it's coming out of the dealer's money or, you know, I don't know, nor do I care. I just think it's an interesting story that they decided to go the other way and say, let's make a bad experience a really good experience.
Yeah.
And when it comes to innovation, that's one of those tips, is find the thing that people say is the worst thing about your business and go after that and do exactly the opposite. If people hate the underwriting process, make it immediate. If they hate the claims process, just approve the claims. You know, find some way to make everything so fast and so easy and so not like everybody else. So I don't know if that's particular enough for you or not, Nick, but you know, but that way of thinking is a way for companies to be, you know, to be really different. And it's not just insurance companies who think of this, it's manufacturing firms. It's I'm on the board of a couple schools, you know, universities and med schools, they're tricky. And any mature industry has not attracted a lot of really innovative strategic thinkers because that hasn't been what they've needed for the last 125 years. So that's not what they're full of. So it's really hard to do that it's really hard to disrupt from within. And I'm, you know, I'm not surprised they're struggling.
Yeah. So let's flip it around for a young insurance professional that's in their career, in the middle or just getting started. How can they become that person as well? Like, how can they set themselves up for quality life, quality career in insurance? But I think more importantly, help be the guiding light to make that change, to help their companies become the Volvo, to create that experience. What types of things would you recommend young professionals do to kind of set themselves up? Because if the tumultuous times exist, that's going to filter its way down to the employee base as well. So what can they do about that?
Well, if you read any of the McKinsey reports, or you read Pricewaterhouse, or there's another great one too on the status of the Ernst & Young does a good piece on the insurance industry every year. I mean, if you work for an insurance company and you don't think your job is in jeopardy, you haven't been reading any of the stuff, because you're in a mature industry with a lot of employees, decreasing margins, high overhead. I have to guess that a significant percentage of the employees are going to go away, either through AI or automation or technology or, you know, something else. That's going to happen. The people who are going to be able to not only survive but thrive are going to be the people who are invaluable. So invaluable to who? The answer is yes. Invaluable to anybody. So, you know, ultimately, I think, because I've done a lot of client-facing work, be invaluable to your clients, whomever they might be. So be worth more than just the guy who delivers the policy, the guy who quotes the price, the guy who pays the claim. Be more valuable. So ask those questions of your clients. What do they need? I've been a $1 million insurance agent, not $1 million of premium, but $1 million of my income in a year more than once, and I've done it part-time, because I've just been around some really valuable, some really high income people, and I helped them with some problem that had nothing to do with insurance. So they hired me for some consulting, and then ultimately they might have needed something which I was then able to help them with, but it wasn't the lead. So I did something that was really important for the client, and then the client had some commodity need and they were happy to do it with me instead of with somebody else. So, you know, I think the lesson from that with insurance, if you're in a commodity business, is you've got to be super special and just do so much more than everybody else. Because if you're selling if you're an independent broker and you're selling a Chubb policy, it's no different than a Liberty Mutual policy. And even if it is, the client doesn't know it. So yeah. the client doesn't even know. So you could be a captive agent selling a product that you think is superior, but a lot of the clients just think insurance is insurance and the premium is the premium. And if your price is that much higher, they're just going to get rid of you. So I think it's becoming invaluable to your client base, whoever that is. And you know, it's easier to do that when you're a bit of a niche. If you have a specialty group, I work with restaurants, I work with doctors, I work with somebody, it's much easier for you to become invaluable when you really know the unique needs of a certain group. So I kind of gave you two different answers there, but.
No, I mean, first of all, you stole my thunder because I was,
sorry.
my curveball to you, the grenade I was going to throw at you was your $1 million producer status. And that is like, right, one way that you can make yourself valuable is be the rainmaker. And it's something that I stress on this podcast all the time is whether you care or not, everyone is a salesperson. So that's why I spend so much time asking my guests about questions and the sales aspect. You want to be valuable. Here you are, applied mathematician. You've been an actuary. You've done consulting. You've done all of those things. And yet, you're not advising in theoretical bullshit, right?
Sometimes.
You're actually producing.
Right. Right.
Right. The rubber is hitting the road when it comes to what you're preaching. You're eating your own cooking. And I just can't emphasize that enough for the, you know, people that are listening, how important it is to become valuable. And there are lots of different ways to do that. And, you know, you can be the person that's insightful. You can be the data scientist that's coming up with a new product. You can also produce. And I think there's a lot of people that don't know they have it in them because they have a stereotype of what sales is. And it's not that. It's what you're saying. You were helping a client and you just happened to help them solve another problem because you happen to be right there helping them with the first one.
Right. And at the risk of overselling, I was, I had become friends with, well, I guess he's my mentor more than a friend, but is Jack Canfield, who wrote Chicken Soup for the Soul. And Jack was doing a book called Mastering the Art of Success. I had already written, I don't know, 12, 13 books. And somebody in his organization I had worked with said, would you mind writing a chapter about selling? Because Jack's books are usually very focused on personal development and a lot of psychology. And there isn't a lot of technical, you know, things. And we think that there's a lot of people who read his stuff, people who are in sales jobs who are interested in personal development. We think it might be valuable and you've been very successful and you do it part-time. Would you mind writing a chapter? And so I did. And the chapter is Increasing Sales Without Ever Selling.
Yep.
And it turned out to win an award, Best Contribution. And it was a pretty good piece. And you know, maybe I'll make that available to your listeners too as a download. It's a good piece and it really talks about partnering with your prospects and giving away ideas and working with them toward an end, as opposed to seeing them as a means to your end. It should be the way around. And I think that that's an invaluable thing for folks who are in a sales or business development role, is to really understand your clients and what they need and then just help them do it, whatever that looks like. And that's what makes you more valuable. And I remember someone once asking me a question in a seminar I was giving about what do you do when clients ask you questions that are so crazy and off the wall, like when would you put your mother in a nursing home, and how about a rehab facility for my son, or they're asking all these interesting questions, where should I send my kid to college or boarding school? And they said, what do you do when you get questions like that? And my answer was, I say thank you. Because if you're an insurance agent or broker and somebody asks you something about their parents or their kids, you are now the trusted advisor. You've gotten to that. If you only get insurance questions, you're not that great. If you get questions about other things, you are. And so that should be one of those takeaways of when you start getting random questions, it's not a waste of time. It shows that they value your opinion, not just value your opinion about deductible selection and riders and, you know, endorsements. They're interested in something else. So
I love that. I do. And kind of going back to something you said about from an innovation standpoint, making the transaction faster, making it in a way where it can get done quicker, like that, you know, in a lot of areas in property casualty, I don't know if life's the same way, things just can't get done quick. They're just like, they're so complex, you know, trying to evaluate the natural catastrophe risk of a industrial facility. Very complex. It's very time consuming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like we recently just had a positive experience where it wasn't, we didn't give them the answer they wanted. Right. And it, which was a bummer. Right. But I think we showed them in that there's also a potential for innovation in that we kept showing we were willing to work with them and not like be a pawn or a sucker for them to do, you know, free work, but like, hey, you know, this didn't work out, but we can think of some ways where it might, if you're open to it, it's just, it's going to be a little bit different. So kind of think about it. And sure enough, they came back. And that's what's going to happen. We're coming at it from a different angle, but it took them a while to do that. And that's part of the innovation and success and, you know, in what you're just describing as well is there are lots of different ways to kind of compute, you know, success, innovation. There's a lot of different ways to come at it. I'm actually going off on a tangent. I don't even know where we were going with this, but you just reminded me of something.
Yeah, thinking differently and looking at this differently and really trying to get comfortable with the clients and figuring out what's important to them is of such great importance. And I've done I've done a number of Lloyd's of London deals with clients on specific things. And what's so interesting about Lloyd's is if they have one very significant concern, they'll just eliminate it. So rather than give the client some crazy quote of, you know, $500,000 for a program, which is a lot, they're like, yeah, well, if we can just remove this one risk that we just can't get our arms around, this whole thing will only cost us $300,000.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. Like, well, that's, you know, that's, yeah. You were paying four, now it could be three or it could be five. You're like, well, three, okay, it's one thing. Then we're just going to work hard to try and protect against that one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's meeting the client where the client wants to be. And I find that the insurance industry very much is, well, this is what our reinsurers are saying, and this is what our guidelines are, and this is what the state has approved. Well, that doesn't make the entrepreneur or the business owner feel like you give a shit about them, because you're going back to, these are all the constraints somebody other than you have given me. So as a result, you have to stick with the meal that I'm going to feed you.
Yep.
And that's just with this generation coming up. I mean, maybe because there's a lot of executives that are in their 50s and 60s and 70s, it's okay. But 20 years from now, yeah, it's not going to fly.
Yep.
So, you know, if not sooner. So, you know, so I think there's there is a need to customize, I think.
Yep. A couple of personal questions. You kind of hinted at this before we started, but do you have any tools that you use to stay productive and or organized?
Tools to stay productive and organized. I'm not the most organized person. So I've got, okay, so here's a commercial for somebody. I use a Remarkable tablet. So Remarkable.
Okay.
The Remarkable tablet is black and white. It's not backlit. It uses ink technology as opposed to light. And I get to take notes, and it syncs with my computer. So I have a Remarkable app on my phone and one on my iPad and on my desktop. But when I go to meetings, I use that. And so I have my Remarkable tablet that I take notes on, and then it syncs and I handwrite. I don't get any notifications from the phone. I don't get any notifications for, you know, an email that came in or something else. So it allows me to stay focused.
That's the one that it feels like paper.
It does feel like paper. It's a very cool YouTube video. It's hard to watch it and not buy one, and I've had one for a while.
I'll put that in the show notes.
It's pretty cool. The other thing that I did, that I got this from Tim Ferriss a long time ago, which is I have no notifications on my phone. My phone hasn't rung in 5 years because I don't turn it on. And so when I'm with a client, especially for those of you on the call who work with people, nobody can ever say, God, I was with Chris and he was on his phone the whole time, or God, his phone kept ringing. When you pick up your phone, it says to the other person that you're not important.
Yeah.
And being in that sales role or even in a meeting with a client, you will never see me reach for my phone because I never get a ring or a vibrate. And I've got kids that range from 10 to 16. So I don't have now 11, I guess. you know, there's nothing that happens that, it's not that I don't look at my phone for 11 hours at a time. I just don't look at it for the meeting for a half an hour, hour, 2 hours, whatever it is. I just don't look. And there really hasn't been anything that I really needed that somebody else couldn't have handled. And so that whole not being distracted by the constant Bing, you know, that giving your undivided attention to whoever it is you're talking to is pretty important. So yeah, you know, that's not an organization thing, but it's an efficiency thing. The other lesson I learned from Canfield, again, my mentor, was I try to make mornings my own. And so I get up and do something for me first before I get into the day. And
what about the kids?
They don't help. They don't make it easy. So, you know, well, so I'm up at 5 and then I do something until 6:15 and then I get the kids up and then, you know, then I'll go take a shower and then I'll just, but I try and get some time for me. It doesn't always work and it's not an always. You know, I think that's something for organization. And then the other thing is if there's something I really want to do that it's on my to-do list or it's an important, or it's a big life goal or it's an epiphany, is I go tell a bunch of people because they will sit on me to say, hey, how's that thing going with how's the giraffe foundation going? Like, shit. Okay. So I haven't filed the paperwork. It needs to get done. And
yeah,
you know, so there's something I do with that. But as far as other than that, I don't have any real cool tools other than, you know, I use Outlook and I hate CRMs. They trouble me tremendously. And you know, I try to hire well and give people things to do to keep me more organized.
I like your answers. Final question that I ask all my guests are due to laziness, because I don't have time to research all this. So why not piggyback off of great ideas? What books have been influential in your business and or personal lives?
What books have been influential? I read To Kill a Mockingbird when I was very young, and I read it again, and it reminds me that to those whom much is given, you have much responsibility to take care of those who haven't. And I try to live by that one. I teach Jack Canfield's success principles, so I find the success principles to be by Jack Canfield to be, it's really hard to say that I don't, since I lecture on that topic and variations of it all over the place. So that's hard not to say that one. I thought the 4-Hour Work Week had some interesting stuff in the back. First half was a little bit harder to get through, but the second half was pretty good. I think for the insurance industry, one of the really important ones is Who Moved My Cheese? So Who Moved My Cheese is you keep doing the same thing over and over again. You know, when the world changes and you don't, it doesn't, something really interesting seems to happen. You mentioned Anti-Fragile already, so I don't need to mention that one.
That's been brought up many times.
I was called that, so I found that to be I've had my fair share of lumps, and it seems like I keep coming back. So I guess
it's a compliment.
It's a compliment. I'll take it.
Yeah,
with graciously and then some. I'm trying to see what's on my shelf over there. Actually, you know what? The book that has had the most influence on my life has been Tom Rath's StrengthFinder. So StrengthFinder 2.0. Gallup did research for decades on people. And as you know, when we first grew up and got in the business, everybody talked about how you would try and become the most well-rounded person you could by focusing on your, you know, your shortcomings so you could be pretty good at everything. And Gallup came up with the new model of let's focus on our strengths and let's hire for everything else.
Yep.
And so one thing that I do that I've made a really big movement on, when I went from, you know, being hundreds of thousands of dollars a year income to breaking the 7-figure number and having a lot more fun, was that I started really focusing on who I was and making sure everybody knew who I was. And part of that StrengthFinder is any client I have or anybody I'm in a strategic business relationship with, I actually pay for them to take the StrengthFinder. So they send it to me and I send them all my personality tests, and I've done, you know, dozens of them. And I just said, I want you to know for sure who I am before you hire me. So if somebody listening wanted somebody for their board or somebody for a strategic retreat, I would send them all my stuff and they would say, wow, you're a very innovative, strategic, creative. This is who you are. If you need an organizational guy, I am the wrong guy and this will not end well. So so for me, just making a point of helping folks understand who they have, a lesson I learned in Vistage was that we hire people based on what they've done and we fire them based on who they are. So we hire people based on what they've done. We fire them for who they are. So you could shortcut all of that aggravation if you tried to go out of your way to find out who people really were, mm-hmm. as opposed to think, oh, you worked at this company and you've been at Chubb and you've been at Liberty Mutual and oh, you must be great. Like, maybe you're an asshole. You just worked at good companies. Like, it doesn't. Yeah. So if you could find out what people's personalities are and what drives them, you'll have a better understanding of what, of whether or not they'll fit in that role. And so, so the whole StrengthFinder thing for understanding yourself, understanding other people. And then there's a bunch of other books they wrote about managing the StrengthFinder and how do you manage somebody who's a execution-based, person. I just found it to be very helpful because it allows you to shortcut, or at least understand what people's natural tendencies are, what they respond well to, what they don't respond well to. And it just helped me be more upfront with who I am and just letting people know this is the kind of guy, if I'm on there, this is the kind of guy you're going to get, and it's not going to be, you won't be surprised.
Transparency equals credibility. As far as I'm concerned, I think you just kind of answered that. So, awesome Friday afternoon. I mean, what I want to do is load this up onto YouTube and then go down and watch it again while my wife is working on her puzzle. So, I couldn't think of a better way to spend a Friday afternoon. So, thank you so much for your time. I learned a ton. We'll put all of the information on the show notes, including the two downloads that Chris has been gracious enough to make available to the audience. We'll have all that. So go to the show notes. Anything you need to get the downloads or any of the information will be on there. And again, I can't thank you enough for your time. I know how valuable time is. And you do as well.
More, it's because of all the money you pay me. Why else would I do it? I'm more than happy to do it. And it's, make it great to help people who are in the space. And if I can be of more assistance, then I'm happy to help. So speak at any time.
I appreciate it. My guest this week has been Chris Jarvis. Chris, thanks again.
It's a pleasure of mine. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, sure.